author of the week on Radio Gorgeous. Fashion on the Ration, Style in the Second World War by Julie Summers. Far from being a story of drabness and misery, this book is a story of colour, inventiveness and determination to carry on regardless of the shortages and constraints of the coupon culture. Fashion on the Ration, Part 2. Not many women had worn trousers before the war, only shocking film stars like Katharine Hepburn and Marlene Dietrich. Were they more acceptable and who wore them?
They were more acceptable in London than they were in the countryside. So when mass observation, which was a group who made surveys of Britons, both before and during the war, when they did a survey in 1941, only 7% of people in the countryside thought it was acceptable for women to wear trousers, and 40% in London.
Gosh, that's a massive difference.
I know, and Vogue decreed that you could only wear trousers as a woman for your work, provided you were taller than 5'5", and you weighed less than 8 stone.
Oh my God, there's not many people.
No, not nowadays, no. So it was very, very strict as to who they thought it was acceptable to wear trousers. But of course, what happened was, particularly during the Blitz, people wore trousers because it was far more practical sleeping in a shelter or crawling under fences or so forth to be wearing trousers. And gradually they became more fashionable. But typically it was the middle classes who wore them first, and it was the working classes who resisted trousers more strongly.
More old-fashioned, yeah. I just want to say, but whenever I see pictures of land girls, they're kind of wearing jodhpurs. Was that...
Oh, the land girls were so proud of their uniforms.
Yeah, can you tell us about land girls?
Well, the land girls tended to come from the cities, and their jobs, the demographic, were girls who'd either been hairdressers or secretaries who were very keen to have the opportunity to do something in the war. They were offered the opportunity either to work in munitions or to work on the land or to take on one of the forces' jobs. But by the time most of the land girls came into the work market, the smart wrens and WAF had all been filled, those places had been filled. So the land girls came from quite... not necessarily poor backgrounds, but certainly not backgrounds that were used to being in the countryside.
Kind of lower middle suburbia.
Lower middle suburbia, and they needed to be equipped. So the land girls' uniform consisted of 18 different garments.
What?
I know! They were dressed from top to toe. The only thing they didn't get were their underwear. So they didn't get their cami knickers, but they got socks and shoes and jodhpurs and long leggings and waterproof trousers, welly boots initially. They got a jerkin, they got a very smart jumper, they got a shirt, they got a neckerchief, they got a hat, they got a long coat. So they were very well dressed, and they, by and large, loved their uniform. But if you think of young girls being 19, 20, 21, and having come from the professions like secretaries or hairdressers, you know, they were really proud of their appearances, and they look great.
Yeah, but I just think it's a very stylish look.
It is a good look, and there are lovely stories from land girls who were so proud of wearing their uniforms, and when they went into town, you know, women would come up to them and ask if they could, you know, buy their shoes off them or buy their breeches off them, but they were too proud. They held on to them.
Now, we know that the wartime was especially a time when there were a lot of rash weddings. So what would one have worn as a wedding dress? Would you wear a wedding dress at all?
Well, yes. White was still very much the vogue. So people wanted to get dressed up and wear a white wedding dress with a veil and a bouquet and white shoes. Some women were more practical and thought that to get married in a costume, maybe a pink or a pale blue costume, two-piece or three-piece costume would be sensible.
Do you mean like a suit?
Yes, like a suit, but lighter weight possibly, so silk or
yes,
light wool. But
like kind of mother of the bride-ish.
Mother of the bride-ish outfit, exactly. And because a wedding would only last 2 hours, possibly three.
Yeah, because you only have a wedding breakfast and go.
Exactly. So people tended to think, well, yeah, they could reuse their outfits, go in. Exactly. Mm. But what is interesting is that if you were a member of the women's forces, you were supposed to get married in uniform, as your husband was supposed to. And Lord Nuffield, on the one hand, and Barbara Cartland, the novelist, on the other hand, were both horrified by the idea of women being forced to marry in their serge, especially in the ghastly ATS uniform. So independently, Lord Nuffield bought 150 wedding dresses from the United States and had them in a warehouse in London, and people could avail themselves of those. And Barbara Cartland bought over 200 wedding dresses from women all over the country, and they could be rented out or used for the WAF, the ATS and the WRENs. And so lots and lots of young women got married either in a Lord Nuffield wedding dress or in a Barbara Cartland wedding dress.
It's a lovely idea. Again, it's deeply practical, yeah. And it's, you know, you just hire it for the day. I mean,
and we had one wedding dress in the exhibition that had been worn by 9 brides. And I have to say, it was in beautiful condition. It looked absolutely lovely.
I wonder if it was posted, you know, or was it, so did they come and collect it?
That I don't know. I have a feeling that particular dress was handed around a family because it came from a big family.
Oh, how lovely, yeah. Lovely. Now, I also read in your book about a siren suit. What's this?
A siren suit, I think today would be probably described as a jumpsuit. Churchill.
Oh, Churchill, fabulous. Churchill, they're really in.
Yeah, they're really in. Exactly. It's sort of onesie type thing. So the siren suit that Churchill wore.
He wore a lovely red velvet one.
He wore a red velvet one, and he also had a green one as well, a khaki green. But that was a one-piece suit, and for women, it had knitted cuffs and knitted ankles so that you could keep out the draft and keep out the dust and so forth. And it had a hood. So you had a pixie hood. So it was very warm and you wore it in the shelter. That was the idea.
Oh,
wonderful.
Yeah. I bet people wore them a lot though, apart from...
Well, they certainly wore them in the shelter and children wore them. That was a great thing that the children would have siren suits, quite often made out of old blankets. And I met a little girl and a little boy who are now in their late 70s, and he had a blue siren suit and she had a fawn siren suit, both made out of old army blankets from the First World War. And the little girl told me that as she got taller, all her mother did was to sew another knitted cuff on the bottom of her trousers, so she ended up with them almost as sort of knickerbockers by the end of the war.
So sweet. Vogue, as we know, you've already mentioned, kept on being published. How did they keep kind of women excited about fashion? How did they give advice? You know, how did Vogue change its editorial approach?
Well, it started out by being quite prescriptive and explaining to women how they should dress, what they should wear, what the fashion was. And it was quite dictatorial initially. It was, this is what's coming out of Paris in 1939. This is what we expect you to wear, how you should do your hair. And then after March 1940, when the American editor went back to New York and Audrey Withers, the British managing editor, took over, she took a slightly more practical approach in that she had people giving advice rather than dictating fashion, because soon after she took over, France fell and fashion that was coming in from Paris completely dried up. So London was having to produce its own wartime fashion. So Vogue had a lot of advice on initially dressing, how to dress, the formality of dressing to evening events when there were going to be soldiers present, so you didn't wear your long dress, you wore a short black dress and so forth. So that was the first bit in the war. And then as clothes rationing came in, they gave advice on how best to spend your coupons. And then later they gave advice on making do and mending. And if you can believe it, there was an article in Vogue on patches. They actually advise you how to patch your clothes. I mean, that really is extraordinary, isn't it? But by the end of the war, they got fed up. That it was quite obvious that the fashion editor was distraught by the lack of change in fashion. And the sort of 6 yearly changes had dried up and there were maybe 1 or 2 fashions per year. And very understated military look. And so what Audrey Withers did was she took on the war itself. And she started producing articles about what women were doing in the war. So she got Lee Miller, the famous American photographer, to go and sit with the girls putting barrage balloons up in London or putting the searchlights up during the Blitz. And she got them to be photographed and interviewed by Lee Miller. She got Cecil Beaton to write an article on the iniquities of rationing. She then got Lee Miller to go over to France when Lee was in France working with the Americans in 1944. She was also posting material back to Audrey about the liberation of Paris and then famously the liberation of Dachau. And Audrey Withers was the first British magazine to publish pictures of a concentration camp in Vogue.
I never knew that.
Fascinating, isn't it? But she felt that Vogue had a role to play in the war, to inform its readership, and not just to talk about the superficiality of fashion.
So it became hard news in a glossy cover?
It became hard news in a glossy cover. And don't forget, from the very outset, the government had relied on the women's magazines to get their message over about anything about wearing short hair so women didn't get their hair caught up in horrible machine accidents, which did happen. They asked Vogue to run an article on short hair, which Audrey Julie did. They asked Harper's Bazaar and Picture Post to feature blackout clothing because the number of people being killed in road accidents rose enormously.
RadioGorgeous.com.
So tell us me about blackout clothing.
So blackout clothing was basically clothing that lit up in the dark. So you could buy bands to put around your hat. You could buy white coats, which were sort of semi-luminous. You could buy lovely luminous buttons to wear on your dresses.
Fun.
Very, very beautiful and very practical. Yeah, but that was a government message delivered by Picture Post. It was government propaganda, but done in a way that was acceptable to
sort of like an advertorial,
But the challenge the government set Picture Post in this instance was to try and find a solution to a very real problem, which was people were getting killed. But they knew that if they prescribed some ghastly outfit that people had to wear in the blackout, people wouldn't wear it. But if it had a fashion element to it, then people would be more keen.
Really, really clever. So we've heard about the shortage of nylon stockings, and is it true that women used gravy browning?
It is true that some women use gravy browning, but I think it was picked up by the press and slightly overinflated. There are lovely photographs, aren't there, of young girls with brown legs having a friend draw a line down the back to show the seam. But what people did use was makeup, and there were certain makeups. There was a thing called Cyclax cream, which Vogue advertised.
You still make Cyclax cream.
Well, there you are.
It's a moisturiser.
Well, it used to be a leg dye, and so people did dye their legs, and they were advised by the fashion editors to wear ankle socks or little slips inside their shoes so that they were able to preserve their shoes, not ruin their shoes with sweaty feet, but still have nice brown legs.
Wow. So can we talk about makeup? I love makeup, and I'm just thinking it must have been rationed.
No, it wasn't rationed. It simply ran out. No, because this is something I hadn't understood, but when clothes rationing came in, the government had to try and provide what they could for as many people in the population as possible. They could never guarantee makeup. So there was no way.
It was seen as not a necessity.
It was a luxury. Mm. And so women who wanted to get lipstick very often had to go and buy black market lipstick. And that was often made in a home kitchen, and it made people's lips blister. It was really quite dangerous. Mm. Face makeup basically ran out in about 1943, 1944. And so Vogue and Harper's Bazaar resorted to old-fashioned methods. So if you had a scraggy appearance, which you haven't, you'd have to say QA 15 times in front of a mirror every day to try and raise the muscles in your cheekbones. I know, it's wonderful. And then if you had calloused hands like I've got, you were... mine's from rowing, actually.
Oh, wow.
But you were advised to take a pair of walnuts and rub them together. And that's an old Chinese method of softening the skin on the back of your hands.
Pinching your cheeks and things?
Your cheeks and running up and down stairs and bending over to keep your tummy straight, but also to bring colour into your cheeks. And using beetroot to dye your lips, using coal to put on your eyebrows. There were any number of solutions, but basically, by the end of the war, there wasn't any makeup to be had.
Good God, that would have been the hardest thing for me.
What about perfume? Did you like perfume?
Yeah, I do. Well, what do they do about?
Well, it was a complete shortage, and Chanel advertised in Women and Home in 1944 to say, you remember our wonderful perfume, please hold on to the smell of that, because after the war it will become available again. And that was a full page advert.
Wow, to spend money, you wouldn't think you should bother.
No, quite.
So I suppose people would use just things like they'd make lavender water or get roses. Yeah.
Roses are very popular. People did use rose petals a lot, certainly.
Yeah.
But the other thing the government tried to insist people did was to look after their clothes and their wardrobes. And
well, you had to.
You had to. But if you followed every single piece of advice the government had given you, you would have spent probably 3 hours a day checking your wardrobe for moths and hanging your clothes neatly. And I think one forgets that in the 1940s, people had far fewer clothes than we have today.
Yes.
So your average middle-class woman would have 3 skirts, maximum 6 dresses. That's winter and summer. So, 3 for the winter and 3 for the summer. And maybe half a dozen blouses and 3 or 4 pairs of shoes. And a working-class woman would probably only have 2 dresses. And a working-class man, just 1 suit.
So did people wash their clothes less?
You washed the under garments, and then there was lots of advice as to how to clean tweed by rubbing oats into it, or washing your silk shirt with a bit of gin, which seems to me rather wasteful because I rather like my gin. But the general advice was, yes, you had to look after your clothes as best you could, and you would wash your undergarments more often than you'd wash your overgarments.
What was the biggest fashion influence, obviously, apart from the propaganda? Was it Hollywood at the time?
No, it was military. It was definitely the military.
So it was fashionable to look military?
Yes, it was. So Paris, in the summer of 1939, had reduced the waist size to 20 inches.
What?
I know. It had, so the waist in the 20s had been flat, flat chest, everything flat. And in the 30s, the waist had gradually come in. The bosom had split into two. The bosom was mono right from 1900 right through to 1934. Mm-hmm. So the bosom split, shoulders pads became larger. And by the outset of the war, this tiny waist had come back in. And British designers simply threw up their hands in despair and didn't follow that route. So they went straight for the military look, which was the square shoulders and the box skirt. And that was the strongest fashion influence during the war.
And that kept through all the way,
yes,
didn't
all
it?
The way through.
Yeah. That probably Hollywood copied. Was that an English fashion then, that look?
Principally, it was an English fashion. Wow. Paris, because Paris didn't have any limits, it was simply had shortages, but there was no rationing per se. Mm. They went off with tremendous flights of fancy and wore the most extraordinary clothes and hats and high-heeled shoes during the war. But the British fashion was for sensible, slightly dowdy, but practical shoes. You know, shoes you could walk 2 miles in.
Because it's really still true.
I know. And trench coats you could sleep in if you got caught on a night out.
I mean, English women are, or British women are still like that. And French people are always more dressed, more, a bit more fancy. I see them on the tube and I can tell.
It's a confidence thing, isn't it, I think, to some extent. Mm. Yeah. Mm.
No, what I'd like to know, Julie, is about the exhibition. What came first, the book or the exhibition? And tell me your relationship with the museum.
The idea for the exhibition came first, and it was a woman called Amanda Mason at the Imperial War Museum, who I've known for a long time and get on very well with. And profile books were commissioned by the Imperial War Museum to produce a book that would run alongside the exhibition. It would not be a catalogue, but it would contain a lot of the same material that was in the show. So once I was commissioned to write the book, which was terribly exciting, I have to say, I was really thrilled to get that offer. I worked very closely with Amanda Mason and we looked at the same material, and a lot of the stories that are in the exhibition are also in my book. And it was a wonderfully productive and creative relationship. The exhibition closed in August last year, 2015, and it's going to open in May in the Imperial Museum North in Manchester, and it'll run for 11 months, which is wonderful. So
great, so we can still have a chance, because I didn't get to.
Well, I really do advise you to go and have a look, and I think the thing that will surprise you more than anything else in the exhibition is the colour, the lovely cuts of some of the clothes, and the incredible inventiveness that people found when they were trying to fashion clothes that would make them look glamorous. Because, you know, young people want to look beautiful. Young women are beautiful, young men look great in their uniforms, war is an aphrodisiac. They did not want to look frumpy and as if they were members of the oldest order of the WI. You know, they wanted to look young and lovely, and they succeeded.
Fashion on the Ration by Julie Summers is available on paperback now. That's what we're celebrating. And it's published by Profile. Thank you so much for coming on to Radio Gorgeous.
It's a very great pleasure. Thank you.
And to buy the paperback, it's out now, published by Profile Books Limited. RadioGorgeous.com.
He was a famous trumpet man from our Chicago way. He had a boogie style that no one else could play. He was the top man at his craft. But then his number came up and he was gone with the draft. He's in the army now, a blowing reveille. He's the boogie woogie bugle boy of Company B. They made him blow a bugle for his Uncle Sam. It really brought him down because he couldn't jam. The captain seemed to understand. Because the next day the cap went out and drafted a band. And now the company jumps when he plays reveille. He's the boogie woogie bugle boy of Company B. A toot, a toot, a toot, a toot, a toot.
RadioGorgeous.com.